Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort indicted, but the bigger story may be the guilty plea from a former campaign advisor. The White House pushes back.
It has nothing to do with the activities of the campaign. It has to do with his failure to tell the truth. That doesn't have anything to do with the campaign or the campaign's activities.
Also today, allegations of sexual harassment on Beacon Hill.
I've covered politics for 20 years, and I worked at the State House for part of that time, and it was blindingly clear that it was going on Beacon Hill.
Plus, we'll take a look at our special Bostonomics series about how tech is changing the future of work. And artist Mark Dion's retrospective at the ICA brings home the joys of an amateur naturalist.
There's a lot of New England in me, you know, and a lot of Massachusetts in me. I'm very much formed by some of the relationships to nature that I grew up with.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And just a couple of hours ago, former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort and his longtime business partner Rick Gates appeared in Washington, D.C. federal court. They pleaded not guilty to charges of money laundering and tax fraud. Those were the first indictments and charges brought by special counsel Robert Mueller. Now, the Manafort indictment may be grabbing headlines today, but there's an even bigger story out there, and it's found in other court documents also unsealed today. Apparently, on October 5th, former Trump campaign advisor George Papadopoulos pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI. And in that plea, he provided evidence that the Trump campaign was aware that the Russian government was trying to help Trump and that the campaign may have been open to accepting that help. Well, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders just held her daily press briefing a little while ago, where CNN's Jim Acosta asked the big question.
How is all of that not collusion?
Look, this individual was the member of a volunteer advisory council that met one time over the course of a year. And he was part of a list that was read out in the Washington Post. I'd hardly call that some sort of regular advisor or, as you want to, you know, push that he's like a senior member of the staff. It's he was not paid by the campaign. He was a volunteer on a, again, a council that met once.
And the individual that Sanders is referring to is George Papadopoulos. Well, let's get some perspective today from Noah Feldman. He's professor at Harvard Law School with a specialty in constitutional studies. Noah Feldman, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Magna.
So first of all, just give us your reaction to George Papadopoulos' guilty plea, which nobody knew about until it was unsealed just today.
Well, it's remarkable because it's the first really concrete, definitive proof that we have of efforts by the Russian government to be in contact with the Trump campaign. Of course, we know from the Donald Trump Jr. meeting that's been widely reported of what may have been that indirectly, but this includes information about contacts coming from the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So it's a pretty direct link. And that's, I think, the most significant fact about it.
Well, so let's dig into some of the details then. Again, in this guilty plea that George Papadopoulos signed on October 5th, I mean, for example, there's in the plea, we learned that Papadopoulos, soon after he learned he was going to be a foreign affairs or foreign policy advisor to the Trump campaign in early March of 2016, he then very quickly meets with someone who's referred to as the professor in this plea a couple of days later, and that the professor in April of 2016 told Papadopoulos about the, quote, thousands of emails that the Russians had about the Clinton campaign. And I presume these are the hacked DNC emails, which then weren't, you know, made public by WikiLeaks until July.
Well, that's possible. We know that there was a reference to thousands of emails connected to Hillary Clinton, and that's what the inference that you draw is a totally reasonable one. But we don't know that from the confession.
Right.
So that's
right.
Still an inferential step that has to be made. I think, you know, the other thing that we have to say, in all fairness, is that presidential campaigns actually do have, all of them, a wide periphery of quote unquote advisors who appear on lists and may or may not have an impact. Sometimes those advisors are hugely influential in a campaign, and sometimes they're entirely on the periphery. And we don't know what was the case here, except to say that Papadopoulos, by his own account, was in regular email contact with superiors in the campaign, and he communicated to them, again, by his own account, requests by various Russians, including the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, to meet with Trump and or to meet with Trump campaign officials if Trump himself was unavailable. So we know that he had regular contact up through the structure of the campaign. It is entirely possible, however, that he was peripheral to the campaign in other ways.
Right. Well, today, reporters asked Sarah Huckabee Sanders about that quite a few times, and in reference to a specific photograph, for example, where George Papadopoulos is photographed seated around a table where Donald Trump is also at the same table. But Sarah Huckabee Sanders said that the president didn't recall, you know, the specifics around that meeting. So you're right. That still is an open question.
We'll have to find out about that, and I'm sure we will.
Yeah. But what are we to make of the fact of these repeated efforts, again, between Papadopoulos and, it seems like, significant members of the Russian government, whoever this professor was, and then there's also a relative of Russian President Vladimir Putin that's referred to in this guilty plea?
Yeah, there are three people mentioned as interlocutors of Papadopoulos in the documents. One is the professor, who's not named, who's described as based in the U.K., and he seems to have been someone who was a connection to the Russians rather than himself a Russian, but again, hard to tell from the documents. Then he introduced Papadopoulos to someone whom Papadopoulos thought was a niece of Vladimir Putin, although it turns out in a footnote to the documents that she was not, in fact, a niece to Vladimir Putin, but was somebody connected to Russia in some way. Mm-hmm. And then there's a third person described whom Papadopoulos met only over email, who's described as, quote, the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs connection, and who is treated in the document as somebody with the capacity actually to connect the campaign to the Russian government, specifically to an ambassador in London. It, again, needs to be said for full disclosure and honesty reasons that no meeting, in fact, occurred.
Right.
Despite the fact that Papadopoulos considered himself to have been invited or to be a potential invitee, and despite the fact that by his account, the campaign said, go ahead and have the meeting if it seems it's a good idea, no meeting, in fact, ultimately took place.
So then back to the question that Jim Acosta asked White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. I mean, he said, is it collusion? We heard her answer that Papadopoulos was a minor player in the campaign. I mean, is what you see in Papadopoulos' guilty plea, do you think that there's some evidence of collusion there?
I would define collusion as going in two directions. I think receipt of information from abroad that helps to help the campaign, which, by the way, doesn't seem to have actually occurred here, but it could have occurred, would seem to me to be one-directional assistance and very bad. But collusion, to me, requires something that runs in both directions. It would have required some coordination or affirmative response or similar action from within the Trump campaign. Fairly read, I don't think these documents themselves show collusion. What they do show is that people within the Russian government were trying, in what appears to be a fairly systematic way, to reach out and make connections with the Trump administration. The $64,000 question is, did they bite? Did the Trump administration ultimately engage in any sort of coordinated communications? Otherwise, this is, you know, a little more extreme than what happened in the Donald Trump Jr. meeting, where ultimately, by his account, he walked away from the meeting saying there's nothing here. Because here you had an American who was at least intrigued and interested, but the campaign ultimately is not shown here to have actively coordinated.
So this this is one of the first actions that we know that that Special Counsel Robert Mueller has taken. We'll get to the Manafort indictments here in just a second.
Sure.
But this George Papadopoulos' guilty plea, like, nobody knew anything about until it was unsealed today. And given the fact that it's one of the first things made public here that we're learning about, vis-a-vis what Mueller has been investigating, I mean, this is early on. So in the history of these things, is this an indication that Robert Mueller may have more?
It's very difficult to judge, and I'll tell you why. On the one hand, you might ask, why did Papadopoulos lie to the FBI? You know, if anyone's out there thinking about this, it's never a good idea to lie to the FBI. If they figure it out, that is itself a crime, and that is exactly what Papadopoulos was charged with. What he did previously wasn't apparently a crime. The crime was lying about it. So there is a question of, you know, what, there was smoke here. Was there fire? Was he covering up something more? If indeed he was covering up something further, it is not disclosed in this document.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that either means that he's told it to the Mueller team, and the Mueller team did not include it in this document because it wasn't legally obligatory to include it, and they were waiting to use it in the future, which is one possibility, or he really didn't have anything further to report, in which case they wanted it to come out today in order to make sure that the Manafort story was not the only story. And we could talk more about why they might have wanted that to be the case.
Okay, so let's do that. But I just also want to let people know we're going to link to all the documents that we're talking about at RadioBoston.org. And the George Papadopoulos guilty plea, let me tell you, it makes for some gripping reading. I mean, the document also says that, like, he was interviewed by the FBI on February 16th, 2017. The next day, Papadopoulos deleted his Facebook account. On February 23rd, he ceased using his cell phone. And then he was arrested on July 27th, upon his return to the United States at Dulles International Airport, arrest which nobody knew about. So Robert Mueller holding a very tight ship here in terms of leaks. But,
absolutely.
But to,
and one also does wonder why, how in the world anyone in this day and age could think that his old Facebook account would not be still accessible. But
yeah,
that's a separate question.
Okay, so to the question that you were raising yourself just a couple seconds ago, like, how does this relate to the Manafort indictment?
Well, what's striking is that it's a different angle than the Manafort indictment, because the Manafort indictment on its own does not draw any direct connection between the Trump campaign and Russia. What we see in the Manafort indictment is that Manafort and his associate Rick Gates were secretly and unlawfully lobbying on behalf of a pro-Russian party in Ukraine, and then ultimately on behalf of the government of Ukraine when that party came to power, that they hid that fact, which was a crime, that they got paid large amounts of money, many, many millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, which they put in offshore accounts, also a crime, and that they launder that money in order to bring it to the U.S. to pay for things like renovations to their Hamptons homes, yet another crime. So those are all crimes. They show us that Manafort was connected to pro-Russian Ukrainians. But all of the events described in that indictment allegedly occurred, again, assuming that they allegedly occurred between 2008 and 2013, so before there even was a Trump campaign.
Exactly, well before.
Exactly. So they're great leverage to flip Manafort, if he's flippable, because Manafort, if these facts are proven, and it seems very probable that they would be, would go to jail potentially for a very long time. But they do not themselves draw a connection between Manafort and the Russians for purposes of collusion. And so you could imagine from the Mueller team's perspective that although they've publicized the Manafort indictment and they're trying to flip Manafort, they also wanted there to be a component in the public narrative where there does seem to be some evidence of potential collusion. And that's what the Papadopoulos documents suggest.
Right. And we still have so much more ahead of us in terms of what Mueller and his team are working on and what the future holds for Paul Manafort himself. And I'm just saying here that Manafort and Gates have been released to home confinement. Manafort on $10 million bond and Gates on $5 million bond. So a lot yet to be discovered and discussed. Noah Feldman, Harvard Law School professor, thank you so much for joining us today.
My great pleasure.
All right, well, let's switch gears here and talk about the fact that all this week, WBUR's Bostonomics team is examining what the jobs of the future will look like and what skills people will need to fill those jobs. It's a very big question, and it's got some very interesting answers. WBUR's Bostonomics reporter Zininger Enwemeka joins us now to talk about the series. Hi there, Zininger.
Hey, Magna.
So this is really exciting because you dug through all the data, for example, from the Massachusetts Office of Labor and Workforce Development. And given that, let's first start off with Massachusetts. Where is the state expected to see the biggest growth in jobs?
Yeah, so the data here clearly shows that in terms of jobs, the future is all about healthcare and computers. And I should note that the data that we looked at includes long-term projections over a 10-year period. So the latest is for 2014 to 2024. So that's what we're looking at here. And we could start with computers. So almost every computer and math-related job is expected to grow in Massachusetts. So think about your web developers, statisticians. The only exception is computer programmers.
Because they'll be programming themselves, practically.
I guess so, yeah, pretty much. And healthcare. Healthcare, we see huge gains across every occupation, from surgeons to home health aides. And home health aides are really leading the growth in that industry.
Okay, interesting. So healthcare, huge industry, huge field, especially here in Massachusetts. But on the home health aid part of things, maybe it, on the one hand, it's great news that there's a large growth projected there, but it's not a super high-paying job.
Yeah, that's right. It's not a super high-paying job. And this is one of the issues that we look at. Our colleague Rachel Zimmerman is doing a couple stories that you'll hear this week around home health aides. And one of her stories really looks at the workforce, which is mostly women, immigrants, and as you said, very low-paying. So it's really a fragmented industry. And she spoke with one home health aide, Yamilee John-Luis, and about her work. She works for this 102-year-old Leroy Newberg, 11 hours a day, 4 days a week.
I do everything for Leroy. I'm his caregiver. I'm his housekeeper. I am his psychiatrist. I'm his reader, I guess. Yeah, I do everything for him.
Yeah. So again, it's hard to find people to fill these jobs. And like I said, it's a fragmented industry. MIT economist Paul Osterman says that if nothing is done here to address some of the issues in this industry, we could see a shortage of at least 350,000 paid caregivers by 2040.
Wow. Okay. So on the one hand, the future of work in Massachusetts means a big growth in some sectors. But what jobs are likely to shrink?
Yeah. So we're seeing big declines in work that's more routine and repetitive. So think about your sort of office and administrative roles. So bookkeeping, accounting clerks. We're also seeing declines in fast food cooks, dishwashers, mail carriers, tellers. Many of these jobs that we see declines, many of the jobs that are shrinking are also ones that are easily automated. This is something that our colleague Asma Khalid will be looking at. Automation and artificial intelligence, both in blue collar work as well as in white-collar work. One person that she spoke with is Josh Weissman, who runs a furniture manufacturing company in Fitchburg.
Trying to find people that want to do this type of work is very, very challenging. You know, when we put a job ad out there, we're lucky if we put an ad out there if we get 5 or 6 responses.
Okay, interesting. Although, you know, you mentioned postal carriers. I really like my postal carrier. He's really nice. But so manufacturing, though, obviously a very important group of jobs there, also changing. But I've been hearing, especially in Massachusetts, that they actually need more high-skilled workers.
Yeah, so this is really interesting. So the jobs that we see declining at the fastest rate are mostly in manufacturing. But you know, even though technology is disrupting manufacturing, it's also changing it. So, for example, we see machinists. There's actually a growing need for machinists. This is something that our colleague Bruce Gellerman is going to dive into at the end of this week. So while technology is really impacting this profession negatively, it's also creating a need for more highly skilled workers in manufacturing.
Interesting. So a real shift there. Okay, so then, I mean, this is a huge issue, the future of work, but what are the biggest challenges to come because of these changes?
Yeah, so yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, there are some big picture challenges here. And what's interesting is when you look at the data, it really gives you a clear picture of job growth and job loss, but it also paints a really interesting picture, Meghna, of the jobs, or excuse me, of the skills that we need in the future. So a lot of technical skills, as I mentioned earlier, computer and math, but also a need for soft skills and personal skills when you think about some of the needs that we're going to see in healthcare. The challenge here is that there's really a mismatch between the skills in our workforce and the jobs that are out there. It's this idea of the skills gap. That's something that I'm going to be exploring this week in a story where I look specifically at an organization that's trying to train people to help close that gap.
Oh, interesting. And I'm education obsessed, so it makes me also wonder if we're educating kids in the right way for these future jobs and to close that gap. Maybe that's for a future story. Okay. But there's also a kind of a fundamental shift in how we work and who we work for, right? I'm thinking about the gig economy.
Absolutely. The gig economy is booming. More and more people are turning away from traditional 9-to-5 jobs and they're doing more contract and freelance work. So this raises some questions about our labor market. I spoke with Diane Mulcahy, who teaches at Babson College and has written a book on the gig economy.
it's actually pretty risky to have a full-time job. And the reason is there is no longer any job security, any meaningful sense of job security.
Yeah, so here we're talking about people are working in different ways, and so we need to rethink our labor market and the structure to give people benefits and make sure that we have laws and policies that support this type of work.
Exactly, because benefits are traditionally tied to full-time employment.
Absolutely.
Right. So you have so much data. There's a lot of data in this series, and you put it all online. So how can people use it?
Yeah, so if you go online, WBUR.org, we have several graphics, including a big interactive feature, and hopefully this conversation hasn't scared you, but if you are curious about what your job is going to look like, you can click on different jobs to see gains and losses, as well as salary information and details about occupations.
Oh, terrific. So Zanindra Enwemeka covers tech and culture as part of WBUR's Bostonomics team. And you can hear her and the entire team's reporting on the future of work all this week on the air, 90.9 WBUR, or online. As Zanindra said, all that data at WBUR.org. Zanindra, thank you so much.
Thanks, Megan. Happy to do it.
And by the way, a little later today on All Things Considered, Lisa Mullins is going to take a look at how vocational tech technical education is helping prepare kids for the jobs of the future. So she's going to answer the question that I asked. Terrific. All right. So that's Lisa next hour on All Things Considered. But we'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's talk about sexual harassment on Beacon Hill. And that's because Yvonne Abraham's Boston Globe column from late last week, well, it's full of disturbing stories of women who've endured decades of harassment. For example, Abraham writes about this one, a young lobbyist who needed a lawmaker's vote on an affordable housing bill. Well, you know how to get my vote, the legislature apparently told the lobbyist, and the young woman tried to laugh it off. But then the legislator apparently asked, if not you, then what about your intern? Well, many other women have had stories of being physically groped. And then there were the incidents of some lawmakers gathered around a cell phone to leer at pornography while in the House chamber. Well, the report drew swift reactions from Beacon Hill. House Speaker Robert DeLeo has ordered a review of sexual harassment policies. And yesterday, Governor Charlie Baker said he was mortified by the report and that there's a zero tolerance policy, he says, for sexual harassment, and that he'll be ordering his staff to review their policy as well.
And we'll make clear in a very explicit way that none of this sort of thing will be tolerated.
Well, the Sexual Assault Working Group from the Massachusetts Women's Caucus is calling for several reforms, including mandatory sexual harassment training for state employees. But is it going to change much on Beacon Hill? Well, Globe columnist Yvonne Abraham joins us to talk about her reporting. And Yvonne, welcome. First of all, let me just ask you, how hard was it for you to find these stories of harassment on Beacon Hill?
I'm afraid it wasn't hard at all, Meghna. I just spent a couple of days making calls, and it was very easy to find the stories, and there were many more stories that I didn't include in the piece.
I mean, it had the feel, reading your piece, that like one woman may have led to another, because a lot of this women have known have been going on for years on Beacon Hill.
That's exactly how it happened, yes. I would speak to one woman and she would recommend the next person, and it just went on like that. And I think everybody knows this has been going on Beacon Hill. You know, I mean, I've covered politics for 20 years and I worked at the State House for part of that time, and it was blindingly clear that it was going on Beacon Hill.
It was blindingly clear when you were working there? I mean, what did you see yourself there, or how did you know it was blindingly clear at that time?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think everybody who goes to a Democratic National Convention or any event that happens at night where there's alcohol involved sees how the culture works up there. You know, there is a lot of after-hour stuff, and there are legislators with a lot of power who don't really answer to anybody but the voters, and the business is built on relationships, and, you know, some women might be reading that situation as like the, you know, going to after hours events is something they need to do to network. And some of the men on Beacon Hill see it as something else entirely.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the things that disturbed me the most about what you found and what the women were telling you was that, for example, I mean, you had cases in which women said that legislators were looking at pornography in the chamber of the House on Beacon Hill, and that many of those legislators are still there. I mean, it's not how much more out in the open can you be that they were so confident that what they were doing was just an accepted behavior? Is that what the women sort of told you?
I assume so. I think also the women would not have said anything because they feel that they would have hurt their own careers by saying something. I mean, it's not just that the women in this column didn't want their names used. They were terrified to have their names used.
Mm-hmm.
Even now, after the Weinstein revelations, even in 2017, they're still convinced that coming forward would ruin their careers.
Wow. I mean, it's stunning, right? Because some of the women told you that they, you know, were assaulted, you know, having various parts of their bodies grabbed, that they were propositioned for sex in the crudest ways. Again, in the chamber of on Beacon Hill, and another thing that you talked about that a lot of women told you along the lines of what you were just saying is that they felt like they had no choice because it's such an insular world on Beacon Hill that if they were going to have any future in state politics, they just had to sort of grin and bear it.
Absolutely. Every job you get is dependent on referrals from the job before. Everything's about reputation and the way people talk about you and how easy you are to get along with. And unfortunately, part of the calculus among some in politics, among some men in politics, is that you know, if you object to the way you're being either harassed or objectified or spoken to, you become difficult. You become hard to get along with. And some of these women were convinced that they would be blackballed if they dared to complain. Mm. And so they came up with, you know, people come up with their own ways to work around the problems. You warn other women off certain legislators. One person told me that she would give interns going up to the Hill essentially mugshots of legislators that they must under no circumstances get into an elevator with.
Yeah, yeah. So forming sort of a protective circle as much as they can.
Right.
But you tweeted on Friday, to your earlier point about being terrified to come forward, women being terrified to come forward here in Massachusetts, that you tweeted that women in politics in California and Illinois have used their names, but not here. And what does that say about Massachusetts politics?
Yes. I mean, I think it says that it's more difficult here to come forward, that women are more afraid here. I do think that if you got a critical mass of women coming forward with their names, then the floodgates would open. But that no women feel confident enough to do that here and now, I think it says something really disturbing about what's going on in this state.
Mm. Now, House Speaker Robert DeLeo, as you know, has said that he's infuriated and deeply disturbed, not by your reporting, but by what's been revealed by your reporting. And he's ordered a review of the House's policies around sexual harassment, which is due March of next year. Do we know what the House's current policies are and if, you know, there's any hope for change?
I think it's great the Speaker is taking this on and that he's spoken about it in such strong terms. There are procedures for reporting harassment right now, and I do believe that the procedures can be strengthened and that that's only a good thing, but I hope that's not all that happens here. I think changing the rules, it doesn't necessarily change the culture. The best system imaginable, it'll be useless if victims don't trust it, and a lot of women clearly don't trust it right now. You know, they don't trust it to protect them and they don't trust it to keep harassment claims from hurting their careers.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Globe is has been asking if more women are willing to come forward because you're investigating sexual harassment in New England. I mean, have more women reached out to you since your report first came out?
They have, for sure. To me and a bunch of women have responded to our appeal, which is on the website. People can contact us confidentially. And we're looking at not just politics, but a bunch of different workplaces across Massachusetts. So I have heard from other women since the story went up, reinforcing the stories that I heard put in the column and telling others from other settings, like in city halls and other places. You know, I knew that I was only scratching the surface here.
Yeah. You know, and as it seems as in a measure of how far yet we have to go in dealing with this problem, because even in the era of, you know, the Me Too hashtag and perhaps a newfound confidence to be able to come forward following the Harvey Weinstein stuff. I mean, I understand that you have actually received some pushback in response to your reporting.
I think people have generally been fairly supportive here.
But?
Well, I mean, I think, I do think we have a ways to go. But I was disappointed to see one legislator over the weekend compare the revelations in the column to something that happened at the ice cream stand you worked at when you were 16 and that you laughed off back then, but you're not inclined to laugh off anymore. I think that really minimizes what's going on here, and I found it dispiriting.
Well, Yvonne Abraham, columnist for the Boston Globe, you can find a link to her piece on sexual harassment on Beacon Hill. We've linked to it at our website, radioboston.org. Yvonne, thank you so very much.
Thanks so much, Meghna.
By the way, Yvonne was talking about Representative Sarah Peake there at the end, a member of Robert DeLeo's leadership team. Representative Peake had said on Friday that she has not experienced sexual harassment on Beacon Hill, but that she thinks it's great that it's in the news and that it may be, quote, causing lots of women to search back through their memory banks. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I think it's fair to say that we've gotten a bit better at talking about dying and end-of-life care over the past several years. I mean, there's Atul Gawande's bestseller, Being Mortal, and also there's campaigns like the Conversation Project that aim to get families talking about end-of-life care. But a bit better means we still have a long ways to go. And that's the topic of today's Common Health segment. And joining us, as she does on Mondays, is Carrie Goldberg, editor of WBUR's Common Health. Hi there, Carrie.
Hey there, Meghna.
So we have talked about this a lot on this show, with you especially. But your latest post on Common Health has this headline, Code Blue Confusion. He checked Do Not Resuscitate, but he wanted to live. What's the story there?
So the story is a cautionary tale by a medical resident at Brigham and Women's Hospital named Abrar Karan. So he writes about a recent case at a different hospital where he was training. There was an elderly man who'd come in just for a CAT scan, just a, you know, diagnostic scan. And suddenly, while he was getting the scan, his heart just stopped. So they called a code blue, you know, that scene we've all seen 100 times on TV where the staffers are all gathered around. They're pumping hard on his heart.
Right. I mean, they get the defibrillator pads out. Someone shouts clear.
Except in this case, a nurse suddenly screamed, stop. This man has an advance directive from 6 years ago saying he does not want to be resuscitated.
Oh, so that's the DNR, the do not resuscitate. So this must have been, is this a dilemma for the staff? I mean, they're trying to resuscitate him and they're suddenly told no?
Right. They're told no, he doesn't want this. And Abrar Karan writes that this news could have just stopped the team, but it didn't seem to make sense because this patient wasn't already close to dying. Like, he just walked into the hospital that day for a scan. So Abrar called the patient's healthcare proxy, his son. That's like his medical decision maker stand-in. And the son said, no, my dad would definitely want everything done to save his life. So they went ahead with the resuscitation, and the patient not only lived, he walked out of the hospital a couple days later.
Okay, so a double close call here, right? His heart stops. He'd apparently, but had he misunderstood the DNR that he'd signed?
Right, apparently. And he did need to be on a ventilator, but only for a few hours. So Abrar spoke with him afterward to clarify things, and he says the patient was first and foremost grateful that they did go ahead.
You guys kept me alive, and like, I can't thank you enough for that. But he said, you know, as long as I was not going to be permanently stuck on a ventilator, I would want to be full code. And so there was a big shift from what was understood from that form, and then what his actual goals were, depending on the outcome of a code.
Okay, so full code, though, means do everything possible to keep me alive?
Right. It's like the opposite of do not resuscitate, right?
Okay, so, but then, I mean, what if you signed it a couple of years ago?
He had signed it 6 years earlier. So, and first of all, Meghna, I want to note here, we usually hear the opposite story, which is that people, you know, at the end of life really don't want to be resuscitated, but somehow the information isn't conveyed. And so their end of life difficulties just get dragged out. But in this case, yes, the man did want to live, but he had signed this do not resuscitate form.
Okay, but he had his healthcare proxy who said, no, he wants to live. Okay, but so this makes me think that in either way, communication is the point, right? To make sure that the patient's actual wishes are known.
Right. So, and the nuances of communication. So Abrar writes that how people answer the questions on those forms about resuscitation depends a lot on how the questions are asked. Like, it matters if you're asked, do you want to be intubated? Or do you want a tube stuck down your throat? Or do you want people pounding on your chest? Or do you want to pass peacefully? And there's been research that shows that it really does matter, that people change their choices depending on how the questions are asked.
Okay, so for example, if you say do not intubate versus something else, people change their answers?
Right. And so we are making progress on this, including that there's a newer medical form called a MOLST. That's an acronym for Massachusetts Medical Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. And it's a form mostly for people who are in advanced illness. But I think, you know, this piece highlights that these end-of-life conversations are still more an art than a science.
And they're still the most delicate conversations we can have.
Yes, they are.
Right.
Yes.
Well, Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health, thank you. Thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
Well, we're interlopers right now. I mean, you can hear that some finches and a canary are more than a little peeved that we're in their space. Sorry, guys. But the marvelous thing about this space is that it's not a park or a nesting ground, but rather, we're inside the Institute of Contemporary Art Boston, and we're at a retrospective of Massachusetts artist Mark Dion's work titled The Misadventures of a 21st Century Naturalist.
So, already by using the word naturalist, it evokes a kind of amateur approach, perhaps, and a less academic, a less purely scientific approach. And so that's something I want to encourage. I'm always interested in looking at the contributions of amateurs and people who are not, you know, academics or professionals.
Dion brings what he calls the purity of an amateur's love to his work. He's an artist and a would-be archaeologist, digging through flea markets and fish markets, abandoned warehouses and the like, to create installations that ask us to ask ourselves, what do our human-created environments tell us about our relationship to nature? And yes, those angry finches and the canary are part of this installation, but we'll get to them in a moment. Let's instead begin with the bird's antecedents, dinosaurs. Or rather, Dion's full-scale diorama of a child's bedroom in all of its primary color Jurassic glory, titled Toys R Us, When Dinosaurs Ruled the Earth.
So what we're looking at is really a kind of period room from 1994, and it's a period room of a child's bedroom. And every aspect of that bedroom, the bed covering, the wallpaper, the toys scattering the floor, the rug, the slippers, are dinosaur-themed. So just about every object in here reflects this kind of commodification of these long-extinct beings.
So many kids fall in love with dinosaurs. And it's like, what is it about dinosaurs that makes them fall in love with it? But it is an entryway into the natural world for so many kids. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, dinosaurs are, you know, they're big, they're fierce, they're also extinct. So you don't have to be so afraid of them. We know that they don't share the world with us anymore. Kids are attracted by that power, but also that's tempered by the fact that they don't really have to worry about running into a dinosaur in the same way you maybe have to worry about running into a bear or a tiger or something. Dinosaurs are from another world.
Before we move on, the other thing about this work that got me thinking was we've got, is that SpaghettiOs? Like dinosaur canned pasta, at least?
Yeah.
Dinosaur shape. And you've got dinosaur cookies. So much of what your work does, it's not just a straight artistic representation of nature. It's sort of a challenging representation of our relationships with nature. I honestly had not thought about this before I saw those. I was thinking so much of a child's entryway into the relationship with the natural world these days is through the act of consumption, right?
Well, like, absolutely. And you know, that children are still guided through the natural world by stuffed animals, by cartoons of bears and lions and things like this, and we still, in the way that I think traditional people always had animals around them to teach them about survival and the forest, we have animals around us who may be artificial, maybe entirely constructed, but they are teaching us norms and behaviors in the same way that the animals in, say, Grimm's fairy tales or Aesop's fables are teaching us.
And what about Dion's own childhood? What was it about growing up in and around New Bedford that gave him such a love of the natural world?
That whole area is just marvelous in terms of its, the depth of history, the important architecture there, that it's a working city. It's still, my mother worked in the textile mills, that they were still functioning. You had the fishing industry there. But also, you still had farmland, active farmland all around. You know, I grew up with an apple orchard next to me, fields. My brother and I could get on our bikes and go to the, go to the salt marshes or go to the ocean, go to abandoned old farms. You know, it was very much like the world in miniature. It was a fantastic place.
So tell me, what does this piece then mean to you?
This is a work... this is the New Bedford cabinet from a project called New England Digs, where I did three sort of archaeological investigations in three New England cities. So Brockton, Providence, and New Bedford.
Meaning you actually did digs, proper archaeological
digs. Archaeological digs at very different sites. And in New Bedford, we dug the foundations of a building that was known as O'Malley's Tavern, which had been destroyed in a gas main leak in 1977.
And so... the cabinet then contains the results of the dig.
Exactly. So we always heard that O'Malley's Tavern was quite a rough place. So we imagined finding, a pool table and all sorts of strange, difficult things there in the basement. And, you know, we found, of course, things going back to the 19th and 18th century, you know, these clay pipes, which, of course, are very common in digs in New England.
Oh, those little glass bottles?
Yeah, little glass bottles. Also, O'Malley's Tavern had previously been a pharmacy. You've got these bottle stoppers. You've got glass and bone buttons and clay marbles and lots and lots of ceramics. And of course, New Bedford's a very harsh marine environment, yeah. So you have this presence of oxidation on everything. You know, time is taking its toll on these objects.
And so, I mean, when we look at this piece, what are we meant to see here with this?
So, well, that's interesting because you and I see this stuff all the time.
Yeah.
We are people who have this privilege of going behind the scenes. We get to see, how the sausage is made in the culture industry.
Yeah.
Not everybody gets to see that. In fact, everyone gets to see an almost kind of sanitized version of this. So, there'll be a dig of thousands of objects, but the museum may only show the one masterpiece,
right,
the one object that tells this story, which is often the narrative of the ruling class in a way. And so this is meant to be very inclusive. You're meant to find yourself in this, but also yourself as part of a long continuity of history.
Now, have you worked with museums?
Very much.
Yeah. So tell me about that, because it makes me think now that, maybe I'm reflecting on something you just said a minute ago. Maybe they ought to pull that stuff back from the storehouses and put it in the display areas so we can see them and interact with them.
Well, that's what I think, too. I mean, when you're in a science museum, very often you are a passive consumer of information. When you're in an art museum, you are a critical appraiser of things. And I want to bring those two things back together. So that's really what this exhibition attempts to do.
Yeah. Fantastic. Now, we're hearing a lot of chirping.
Yes.
Should we go see the source of that?
Let's go see the source of that.
We turn a corner, and there, filling another room, something that looks like it's materialized right out of the notebook of a precocious child naturalist. A little Darwin-esque, but with whimsy. For there is a huge black cage, home to those quarreling birds. But closer inspection reveals more. Some books dangling from the branches of an old tree, antique pictures, and even some quotations.
Well, what we're looking at is an aviary. It's a large circular space that visitors can go into, and at the center of this is a pretty significant dead tree. And its branches spread out, and those branches are filled with books and objects. And in this aviary live 18 zebra finches and 4 canaries.
So we can actually go in.
Yeah, we can go in.
Let's do that.
So now we are in the aviary with the birds. And As you see, we can get very close to the birds.
Yeah.
And the longer you're in here, the more habituated they become to us. So, you know, it's not uncommon to be in here and have the birds land on you. And but also I think what's really interesting and exciting to me is the more time you spend in here, you begin to recognize the birds are individuals. They are not, you know, they're not carbon copy wind-up toys. They have different kinds of behaviors. Some of them are, you know, some of them are bullies, and some of them are wimps, and some of them need to be in a group, and some of them are very individualistic. And you see that that one was that there is gathering nest material. So I think that's what I want people to experience, is that kind of, we can have this proximity to them. We can see and enjoy ways that they're similar, but at the same time, they very clearly have a different set of priorities and a different way of seeing the world.
So, oh, there's so much to talk about this piece, because most of the time in the wild or even in a park, when you get close to birds, they rightly fly away. But here, right, since we're in the aviary, and as you said, they can get used to us, they're not doing that. So it sort of heightens my sense of feeling like a true interloper into their world.
Yeah. This feels like their world, but also...
But it's not.
It's their
really.
World with our priorities.
Our stuff,
right?
Exactly.
It's surrounded by all of these books. And these are books that I believe would be very helpful for birds to know something about. You know, there's a whole section here about cats, and there are books on chemistry, and there are books on the history of natural history, and books on migration and geography.
I mean, you've got books about environmental ethics and our wild heritage and a portrait of Rachel Carson.
Right. Rachel Carson and Marjorie Stoneham Douglas and John Muir and a number of people who have made contributions to the idea of saving wild things in wild places.
Now, I have to say, I feel both just, this is like a really wondrous and wonderful space to be in. But when you use the word that the birds are indifferent to the sort of human material surrounding them, it also made me wonder if you're saying that we're indifferent to some of the lessons and the thought and the thinking that are in the books here that you have.
I mean, that certainly would seem to be the case, right? That this information is equally available to us, perhaps even more available to us, and yet it still doesn't kind of resonate in our culture the way it could and should.
So this is the first time that a collection like this of your work has been shown in the United States.
Yeah, this is my largest survey to date in the United States.
And what does it mean to you that it's happening here in Massachusetts?
Well, you know, there's a lot of New England in me. I'm very much formed by some of the relationships to nature that I grew up with. You know, here, you know, my understanding of nature was never this kind of vast, untouched wilderness. It was always nature side by side with an urban context and a suburban context, and there's nothing pure or pristine about it. That doesn't make it any less nature for me. So when I think about nature, I'm not always thinking about wilderness. I'm thinking about something existing in our backyard. So that is very much forms the way I think about wild things and wild places. It doesn't have to be this model of the pristine.
Yeah. Well, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
And
for me too.
The work is absolutely remarkable. Thank you so,
Thank
so
you.
Much.
Thank you. It's really been fun.
Artist Mark Dion, his retrospective, The Misadventures of a 21st Century Naturalist, is on at the ICA through the end of the year. And of course, as much as I love radio, I've got to tell you, this is one you need to see with your own eyes. And we've got some information and some pictures to whet that appetite, especially pictures of that artful aviary. It's all at radioboston.org. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek. We've had help from Cassandra Sunt, Zoe Mitchell, and Brian Bouchard. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Today we had help from Mike Muschetto. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.